This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Now that the legal hurdles are all apparently cleared, the California recall election is headed for the finish line. October 7th is less than 2 weeks away. For those of you who may have nodded off waiting for the courts to decide, part one of the California ballot is a referendum on the incumbent governor, Democrat Gray Davis. Should he be recalled, yes or no? Part two lists 135 candidates who would like to replace him. If Davis loses the recall, whomever gets the most votes replaces him in Sacramento. If he wins, part two was a very interesting popularity contest. Tonight, the five best-known candidates debate at an event sponsored by the California Broadcasters Association. It's the only debate that actor Arnold Schwarzenegger has thus far agreed to. His critics say it's no coincidence that the format provides the questions in advance. Later in the program, we'll find out why and how they picked just five candidates from such a big field, and we'll hear some of the questions. Now, I've seen the list, and these are all important questions, but while infrastructure spending and local government support may be worthy issues, they lack a certain zing. Is there a question you'd like to sneak into the hand of the moderator tonight? What question do you want to hear? Email us, TOTN, at npr.org, and we'll read some of your questions throughout the hour. And as if this unusual election was not twisted and turning enough, the man who essentially paid for the recall, Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, now says that if one of the two Republican candidates does not pull out of the race, he wants Californians to vote no on the recall. We'll get into all of these tactical questions with you in just a moment. But there are questions also about the nature of what is going on in California, which has made the state a laughingstock. Literally, a laughingstock on television programs. Joining us now from member station WUFT in Gainesville, Florida, is Dan Smith. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Florida in Gainesville, the author of a book due out next year called Educated by Initiative, The Democratic Effects of Citizen Lawmaking in the American States. And good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
It's my pleasure, Neil.
Now, I understand you believe the recall process has actually been good for the democratic process. Tell us why.
Well, perhaps I'm just looking through it through rose-tinted glasses from my vantage point here in Florida. But irrespective of what one thinks of Governor Gray Davis and this $35 billion budget deficit, I do think the recall is actually good for the democratic process. It's something that harkens back to the progressive era, in which folks who pushed for direct democracy reforms in the 1910s and a little earlier, the initiative, the popular referendum, and the recall actually pointed to these educative effects, these indirect processes that are going to be enhanced by getting citizens involved. And yes, while it is a circus, I think it's a pretty good show, and people are engaged in this recall process, not only in California, but across the nation.
They're also a little bit confused. 135 candidates, and we don't have time to sort them out. It's such a short election.
Well, California does send out ballot pamphlets, fairly large, with respect to
these
number of candidates. They have to be very large. I haven't put my hands on it. I've seen it online, but I imagine it is quite large. And many of those candidates who are going to be on the ballot have already officially withdrawn. Now their names are still going to be on the ballot.
And boy, that's going to lessen confusion.
Well, not necessarily, certainly, but, you know, it is getting people involved. A recent field poll, for instance, said that over 95% of people who are planning on voting are watching and following this election very closely, and that's up almost twice as what it normally is.
Now, do you think that this greater interest is going to translate into higher turnout?
Well, it's hard to predict, but I would imagine so. We're already looking at the number of absentee ballots coming in. I imagine it will be well over a million. Right now it's around 600,000. Certainly I think it's going to be higher than the 2002 turnout in California that put Gray Davis into office, which was just slightly over 50%. California generally has fairly high turnout. And I would argue, as well as my co-author Carolyn Tolbert at Kent State, that this is because they have a bevy of ballot initiatives every year that also get people turning out and interested in politics.
Yes. Now, all of that is going on. At the same time, there are some people say that California's budget problems are caused at least in part by the same kind of direct democracy, which has put a lot of measures into state law mandating that the state must spend certain amounts on certain things.
Neil, that's an excellent point, and one that I think we need to look at the process in two parts, as the progressives actually did. They contended that the initiative process would allow for substantive change at the ballot. At the ballot box. And indeed, we have seen that. California itself has had 99 initiatives passed since the initiative and referendum was adopted in 1911 and the first election in 1912. That said, and I would agree completely, and Peter Schrag out in California and others have written about how this has hamstrung the state legislature, many of these initiatives, and has led to this $35 billion deficit. That said, I think we also have to hearken back to the progressives who said that this process was going to be good for democracy. It's going to help provide more political information to citizens. It's going to help generate interest in politics. It's going to help citizens discuss politics, become more active citizens. It's going to increase political efficacy, the trust and confidence that citizens have in government. All of these things, Carolyn Tolbert and I have found, actually are happening in states that do have the initiative process. So I think we need to separate the substantive instrumental ends of the initiative process with the procedural side, these educative effects, as progressives called them.
Well, then that may be another procedural question. We see in California anybody with $3,500 and 65 signatures can get their name on the ballot. Shouldn't the bar be just a little higher?
Well, certainly, the legislation, the amendment that was passed in 1911 wasn't looking at rates of inflation and whatnot. Certainly, we could see that bar a little higher, and possibly we will see that change as a result of this. We also have to remember that one individual, essentially, Dara Issa, who put up about $1.8 million to get this recall on the ballot. And that's something that is indicative of direct democracy. It does allow populist entrepreneurs to go ahead and put out their pet projects and tap into some common sentiment and use the process perhaps to push their own personal agenda or a special interest agenda. That said, citizens also have a chance to strike these things down at the ballot box. And as we see, the polls are indicating that Gray Davis actually may pull this thing out on October 7th.
So if this were to happen on a national level, perhaps we would all quake in fear at the words Ross Perot.
Well, I mean, we don't know that it's not going to be extended. Around 20 states allow the recall of gubernatorial people, of governors, and as well as other state senators and members of the House of Representatives and other offices. There's a recent recall effort, it sounds like, going on in Wisconsin to recall Governor Doyle, who's a Democrat. This may be something to watch out for on the national horizon. I think if it happens in a great bulk, that it may not be the best thing for democracy. But in these small bits, I don't see any real problem. I actually think it does energize the public. We've seen about 180,000 new registrants in the last month in California to register to vote. And I think that's good for the democratic process.
Well, Dan Smith, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Dan Smith is an associate professor of political science at the University of Florida in Gainesville. His book, due out next year, is Educated by Initiative, The Democratic Effects of Citizen Lawmaking in the American States. And he was with us from the studios of member station WUFT in Gainesville, Florida. And joining us now to help make sense of all of the twists and turns in California is Sherry Bebich Jeffy. She's a senior scholar at the University of Southern California School of Policy Planning and Development and a contributing editor for the Los Angeles Times. She's with us from NPR West in Culver City, California, and it's good of you to come back with us.
Thank you, Neil. It's a delight to be here. A couple of clarifications of Mr. Smith's discussion. Many candidates have not withdrawn. In fact, 133 of the 135 candidates are still active. Peter Uberoff and Bill Simon have turned their campaigns off, but everybody else is running around. And I don't know if you saw Jay Leno the other night. He had 90 of them in the audience. It was quite a scene. Also, the deficit, which is a $38 billion deficit, which is now an $8 billion deficit, was caused by a whole lot more than the initiative process, although the initiative process really did make flexibility very difficult. And
I think we did say at least in part caused by the initiatives.
And this bar for qualification as a candidate, we can thank Secretary of State Kevin Shelley. There's no qualification guidelines in the Constitution, and he decided to be fair and to prevent the possibility of suit from a voter or a potential candidate, he would use the qualifications for a city council candidacy in a recall, and that's why it's so low. And Professor Smith is right. I think that's one of the first things that's going to be changed.
Well, as he also mentioned, the man behind, the man who funded the recall movement and is largely, I guess, responsible for its success, Darrell Issa, a Republican who wanted to recall Governor Davis, now says he may not want to recall Governor Davis, kind of depending. What's going on here?
Guess what? I think he got religion because he has gone on television, and it's reported in the papers out here today that he basically said, never mind. He's going to take a look at the debate tonight, he says. He's going to look at the numbers, and he said, likely, he will vote yes on the recall because that's what he wanted more than anything else to begin with, to recall Gray Davis, and probably yes on Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Hmm. So his threat to suggest that Republicans vote mm-hmm. no on the recall, just posturing them?
Oh, the Republican leadership went apoplectic, Neil. I mean, really telling the Republican faithful not to vote yes on the recall. There was some speculation that it was all some kind of a sneaky strategy to get the Republican faithful revved up and angry. I doubt that because I think they came down, the leadership came down hard on Darrell Issa to withdraw that idea.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's start with Tom, who's on the line with us in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be able to participate in what's invariably a thought-provoking show.
Oh, well, thank you.
My comment, rather than question, just has to do with Mr. Issa. And all along, the claim has been that this was not an attempt to undo the last election. It certainly wasn't partisan, no, no, no. And all of a sudden, his comment the other day that perhaps Republicans should vote no lest they split their vote and still end up with a Democrat in office. I know those weren't his words, but, you know, reading between the lines, that seemed pretty obvious.
Pretty close.
I think that just makes it fairly plain the merits of their claim that it was never partisan. And I think the Republican leadership coming down on him had more to do with how transparent it was rather than an objection to the idea behind what he said.
Well, well, Sherry Babich Jeffy, I mean, are we shocked to see that politics is going on here?
I am stunned. I am stunned and shocked, yes. I mean, any kind of a move against an official of the other party, any kind of move in the political and governmental arena is political. I will tell you, though, it's very interesting to look at the new Public Policy Institute of California poll. This has become a polarized election, with most Republicans supporting the recall. More than a majority, but not as high a percentage of Democrats against the recall. There is some partisan polarization going on, but it's been going on for years. I think had not Darrell Issa spent $1.7 million to qualify the recall as quickly as he did, there was a good chance that the recall would qualify, but not for this October. The decision to go for this October on the basis that it would help the Republican Party because it would be a special election was the partisan part of the decision, I think.
And don't forget, we have an email challenge underway for you guys. If you'd like to suggest one of the questions that ought to be asked at tonight's debate, remember, all the questions have to be in advance, email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Daniel Sapin-Borson in Portland, Oregon, suggests, if you win, how much time do you think you should get to solve California's budget problems before you should be subject to a recall campaign? Send in your suggestions to TOTN at NPR.org. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the recall election. California Governor Gray Davis has to face the voters on October 7th. There's also another election to decide who would replace him if he loses. That all happens less than 2 weeks from today. Tonight, five of the people who want the current governor's job will get to answer questions in a debate format. The questions are being provided in advance. We're going to find out why and a little bit more about that debate in a few minutes. But we have an email challenge going on. If you could slip a question into the moderator's hand, what would it be? What do you want to hear the candidates answer tonight? Our address is TOTN@npr.org. You can also join the conversation by telephone, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our guest is Sherry Bevis Jeffy, a senior scholar at the University of Southern California School of Policy, Planning, and Development. And let's go into another phone call. And Gary's on the line with us from East Aurora in New York.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Gary. Go ahead.
When I first heard that there were people who were encouraging others to withdraw from the race, the first question that I had was, what about those people who have already voted? First of all, the ballot that they voted on had these people on it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, they may have actually voted for them. What about those people?
Well, Sherry Bevis Jeffy, would they be their names, I guess, of those candidates would still be on the ballot. So the people might feel disenfranchised, but they got to cast a valid vote.
That's exactly right. The name of all 135 candidates, the names are still on the ballot. And I assume you're talking about the pressure on Tom McClintock, a Republican, to withdraw in favor of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Those 700,000 or more absentee ballots that have already been cast, plus voting early, which begins today, well, there will be people who vote for Tom McClintock, and my guess is Tom McClintock will be there standing on Election Day. This is a guy who has just dug in his heels. He is a maverick. He is a true conservative. Ideology is critically important to him, and it doesn't sound like he's going out of the race anytime soon.
Gary, thanks very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Let's talk about money for a little bit, and this has come up. Obviously, Cruz Bustamante has had his own problems. A court ruled this week he had to give money back from a previous campaign. He couldn't use
right.
that money for this campaign, and then his manager said all that money was gone anyway.
I thought that was a little astounding, but I quite frankly wouldn't doubt that Richie Ross was telling the truth. I mean, I am sure that money has by and large at least been committed and placed. The interesting thing is the judge also ruled this is all a result of another initiative, Proposition 34, which instituted new campaign financing reforms after the 2002 gubernatorial election for gubernatorial elections. And there's a limit on contributions now. But even if there is money left, and even as the judge demanded, it goes back to the, what, quote, pre-Prop 34 committee. From that committee, Bustamante can return the money to the Indian tribes and the unions who gave it to him in the first place, and there is nothing to stop independent expenditures on behalf of the candidate on the part of those contributors. Isn't that delicious?
Well, speaking of the Indian tribes, this has come up in another money issue. Of course, this is political advertising. Mm-hmm. And this is an ad that's been running on behalf of Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Indian casino tribes play money politics in Sacramento. $120 million in the last 5 years. The casinos make billions, yet pay no taxes and virtually nothing to the state. Other states require revenue from Indian gaming, but not us. It's time for them to pay their fair share. All the other major candidates take their money and pander to them. I don't play that game. Give me your vote. I guarantee you, things will change.
Now, Sherry Bevis Jeffy, I guess that's sort of a blanket negative ad. All of them are bad. All of them.
Every one of them. Even those who contributed to his Proposition 49 in the last election, I guess.
But nevertheless, this issue of Indian casino tribes is a big one in California.
Yeah. It has become a big one in California because I think, quite frankly, Neil, the way that Cruz Bustamante has handled or mishandled it. I mean, he has tried in various ways to remove the money, refunnel it into something else. And what California voters don't like, they understand that every politician takes special interest money. And they understand that at times that means that they're not going to get what they want. But they want what they want, and they don't want that money kind of taken and administered in a duplicitous way. They think politicians who lie, who, shall we say, fudge the truth, are the real problem at this point in time. That's why Gray Davis is in so much trouble at this point. He is perceived as someone who doesn't often tell the truth, doesn't often level with the electorate. And Bustamante just stumbled all over this. And now it's being used, this whole issue of campaign financing is being used as a character issue. And Bustamante is not stepping up to the plate to deflect it. In fact, since it began to be used, his disapproval ratings have increased at least 9%.
Now, who's got the best special interest, anti-special interest ad out there? I mean, Arianna Huffington has the brothel cartoon and the special interest brothel cartoon, and we just heard.
Well,
Arnold
that's on the internet. I think. Yeah. I haven't seen it on television, but let me put it this way. You've got Schwarzenegger out there. You've got McClintock out there with the help of the Indian tribes. And you've got Arianna on the net because I don't think she can really afford a very broad placement on either broadcast or cable television. But in the end, you know, what voters truly care about is what have you done for me lately, or what will you do for me once you are in the governor's office? Negative campaigning works, but only negative campaigning doesn't work.
Let's get another caller in. Doug joins us from Indianapolis.
How are you guys doing?
Okay.
Hello.
I've got a question. You know, right now we've got an administration in the presidency that's a little bit, some people view as questionable because of the whole Florida situation. And the thing that's happening in California that concerns me right now is that it's very likely, or at least highly probable, that Gray Davis will not... He will be recalled by a thin margin because it'll just take the majority. And then the vote is going to be split so many different ways that the person who wins could have far fewer votes for them to be in office than Gray Davis would have had to stay in office.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It seems like there's a lower standard to elect somebody in than there is to take the person out. And so how is that administration supposed to have any kind of legitimacy when fewer people wanted that person in office than wanted the person in office they took out?
That's a very good question, and it is a part of the debate out here. It was early on one of the major arguments that the governor made against the recall, and in fact, he went to court to demand that he then could go on the recall replacement ballot along with the other 135 candidates who are running to replace him. But the court said no, that the Constitution does not allow that. And there is a real possibility that the governor may get 49%, I mean, not the governor, the no on recall, and we've got to continually remind ourselves that Gray Davis isn't really on the ballot. No on recall could get 49% of the vote and pass the recall, while the highest percentage of vote, the guy who replaces him, could get 20, 30, 40, maybe even 15%. The conventional wisdom, it's going to be, if it happens, it'll be 30-40%, but that's still 9% less than 49%.
Doug, thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil.
And as you know, we've got an email challenge going, questions that you'd like to see presented in tonight's debate that may not be on the list. And here's one from BJ in Louisville, Kentucky. What changes, if any, will you bring about to the recall laws after you're elected?
Good one.
Joining us now is one of the organizers of tonight's debate. Mark Powers is vice president of the California Broadcasters Association. He's with us by phone from his office in Sacramento, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Hello, Shelley.
Sherry. Hi.
So how come the questions are given out ahead of time?
Well, basically what that stems from is a frustration from, and I'm sure Sherry can vouch for this, over the past decade or so of the leading candidate coming in and saying to all the other candidates, if you want to debate me, we're going to debate at noon, on a station that nobody watches, and we're going to stand up, we're going to have notes, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and if you don't want to do that, then I'm not going to square off, with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically then we said, there's got to be a way to take control away from candidates. And so what we did was we gathered a bunch of pollsters, journalists, political consultants, academics, election experts, and we got them into a room in Sacramento last spring and said, what can we do to scare candidates to death and yet make them show up at a debate? And all the campaign managers in the room said, we have never been surprised by a question in a regular debate. What we do is we script out these answers, 1 or 2 minutes. We apply them to 20 or 30 different questions. We try to stay on message. If you really want to scare the hell out of candidates and their campaign managers, give them the questions prior to the debate, raise the expectations of the audience, and say, okay, we're going to have a conversation about these that you can't predict. Even if we give you a bad question in a regular debate, you only have to suffer through it for a minute, and then you're on to something else. Suppose you have to suffer through that 10 minutes with every other candidate hammering you on that answer. I guarantee you, you will see a revolt among the candidates for something like that.
Mark, boy, did those guys sell you a bridge. Don't you really believe that any candidate worth his or her salt can handle any question? I have to tell you, and I don't do this to embarrass you, but I handed the 12 questions to my students in Communicating Public Policy, a graduate seminar, and they guffawed. They are, I think, softball, and they did too. They are highly generic, and they thought it looked like a take-home exam in Civics 101. What is your top priority for California?
Yeah, well, Chair, you have to remember that these questions are designed to open a conversation. And so what will happen is the question gets asked. One candidate has 60 seconds to start that conversation. At that point, it opens up to everybody. And so it's you find out for anything from what their top priority to what it strays into this to where it strays into that. What this debate is designed to do is show people's character, how they react under pressure, what
their personality
looks like, and you know, things like that. I mean, it isn't designed like a regular one. Okay, you have 1 minute. Now you have 1 minute. Now you have 1 minute. It's one of those things that if people want to know a candidate, it's like having them all in your living room and asking them a question and saying, okay, go to it.
Mark, just recently there was a debate in Los Angeles that the L.A. Press Club put on in which there were not pre-scripted questions, but they divided the hour up, and each candidate had something like 16 minutes and could use it in any way they so choose. Don't you think that that's really a better judge of character when you don't have the time to write out your answers, to plan your strategy, to memorize what you're going to say no matter what anybody else says about the question? You don't have to do 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute.
Yeah, but that's a different format and a different debate, and they've elected this one. Here's another question suggested by one of our listeners. Rather than ask yet another question concerning policy, I'd like to see the moderator ask a simple question or two regarding the candidate's knowledge of California. For instance, how many counties are there in California? It's too bad, suggests Brady Richards in Chico. It's too bad there won't be time or opportunity for an additional debate with Alex Trebek as the moderator. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mark Powers, one thing you said was that everybody would get a chance to respond and get in on the conversation. Well, obviously, not everybody. You picked 5 out of 135, and how did you draw that line?
Well, basically, what we had to do was, as you know, in order to do a debate, you have to use your best news judgment, because any time you have a vote, there's a lot more people that want on television than it can actually accommodate. So basically what we did is we looked at the 3 public polls and we said anybody over 10% in any one of those 3 polls is automatically in. If you're between 5 and 10 and we haven't got to 6 candidates yet, then you're in. If we still haven't invited 6 candidates by the time we get you know, to 5%, then we'll start going down. Luckily, we went to 4 and 3, and everybody else is under 1%. So we got our 6 from those 3 public polls.
And again, this is not the only debate. You're not entirely responsible for the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger has only agreed to participate in yours. But the you know, it still leaves open the question. You're only accepting people who may have been able to buy or have otherwise access to name recognition.
Exactly. And if we don't do that, what you end up is like what happened on the Jay Leno show. You can't show any one of them without some type of satire. All you can show is a wide shot, you know, and how do we put 135 people into a room and get any type of conversation? And so, yes, I mean, basically, we run into that problem in every single debate we have, because you've got a whole ballot worth of people, and you can only put a few of them on for a discussion at any one time.
Now, what's the debate is only hours away. Now, what's the atmosphere like?
Oh, well, I think that there are more credentialed media out there than I think I've ever seen at any type of function before. I think there's over 400. They've come from all over the planet. You know, I don't think there'll be anybody who has a TV or radio on the planet who can't actually get this. And, you know, we've got Austrian TV that came in. Like I say, the BBC is here. People from India. It's like it's just an international phenomenon.
Okay. A couple of more suggestions for questions. This one is from Christopher Owens. Give voters a real sense of the differences between candidates' priorities, with a bow of thanks to KTCA Public Television in Minnesota that used this technique during last year's gubernatorial election. Give each candidate $100, take out the percentage dedicated by initiatives, have them divide up the rest by putting it in piles by budget categories that reflect California's mix of state services and tax relief, then compare the results with current budget allocations. There's a pretty good telegenic suggestion. And finally, this one from Carl Peltier, I guess it's pronounced. He's come up with the best question so far. To the candidates, what would you do to increase funding for public radio in the state of California? Mark Powers, good luck tonight.
Thank you.
Mark Powers is vice president of the California Broadcasters Association, which is sponsoring tonight's debate. And he spoke with us from his office in California. And Sherry Bevich-Jeffy, we have 30 seconds left for you. What should we look forward to in this debate?
Well, everybody's eyes will be on Arnold Schwarzenegger, and this is his opportunity to either convince Californians that he's real, that he's a candidate, or to leave the impression that he's just another celebrity who's trying to get a new career.
And that, I guess, is going to be a question that will be answered not just tonight, but over the next couple of weeks, and certainly on October the 7th when the ballots are counted. Sherry Bevich-Jeffy, right. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Sherry Bevich-Jeffy is a contributing editor to the Los Angeles Times, and she's also a senior scholar, at the University of Southern California. When we come back after a short break, we're going to be talking about the impulse of Americans to move. We have always been a mobile society, going from place to place to place. Are we more mobile or less than we used to be? The census data on that particular question has just been crunched. We'll have an analysis when we come back from a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.